flowers.
I have flowers.
Okay, so a few technicalities before I really start. One is my talk will follow a handout, and it's on the screen right now, and it's barely visible. But I made a copy, and it's the second page in the handout packet that I hope everybody picked up on the way in from outside. One comment is that the few further handouts may or may not be used in the further lectures. It's more options than a commitment. Or also, you know, if you end up asking me questions about them, that's wonderful, but it's not, that's not the guaranteed sketch. The other comment is that I'm videotaping these lectures so that my own students will be able to watch them when I'm back home. But in fact, I'm going to post them on this lecture series website. So you can watch them too. But again, the fact that it's being videotaped is not a guarantee of quality of any kind. It's just to make it available for the few students of mine that were not able to come. And finally, about the content. So I'm going to talk about expansions. And in some sense, expansions are just Taylor expansions, or various variations of Taylor expansions. So, you know, you all know the Taylor formula, right? F of x is sum of x to the n divided by n factorial divided by multiplied by the nth derivative of x0 or something. I hope I didn't mess up. And it's all very basic and routine, except I'm going to generalize it vastly and talk about it in several other contexts. And, you know, it's everything that I'm going to do is going to share the power of Taylor's theorem. So it approximates functions. It's sometimes easily computable. It sometimes allows you to compute things that you would not be able to compute analytically. So, for example, you can solve differential equations by iteratively figuring out their Taylor coefficients. So there will be an analog of that in things that I will do. Taylor series tend to carry in them a huge amount of combinatorial information. So this is what is called generating functions, right? Whenever you have a series of coming from combinatorics, you tend to pack it together and put it as a Taylor series. So what I'm going to tell you is all these elements of power with Taylor series, but also it's going to share the weaknesses. So many things in mathematics, you know, many functions do not have Taylor series. So many things cannot be described in terms of expansions. Now, the main surprising thing, moral, that you should take out of my lecture series is how deep it is, how surprisingly deep, or how surprisingly much you can say about the Taylor series once you generalize it enough. So my base plan will be to talk about expansions starting from physics, so perturbative expansions of path integrals, and then moving on to topology and various parts of algebra. Maybe before I start, my best guess is that it would be useful for everyone if I start with a little bit of a preliminary discussion of what Feynman diagrams are. So am I right to assume that, you know, or let me ask you differently. How many of you feel comfortable with, you know, given a Lagrangian can write down the Feynman rules? Right. So a small number.
It's not a question.
Okay. So therefore, that will be my first serious goal. Okay? But that's not what I'm going to start with. Because you see, when you go to the movies, often they start with a splash screen, with a splash scene. Okay? So, the movie starts right away with a chase, lots of adrenaline. Okay? And after the chase is over and you realize who are the good guys and who are the bad guys and who's James Bond and who's the enemy, then the movie goes to a more leisurely place and you see some discussion in some back room about Feynman integrals and things like that. So I'm going to start with a little bit of a splash scene, but you see, it's going to take most of the first hour because, I do have 6 hours, so I may as well start with it. So I may as well take some time for it. So I guess I'll start with Stonehenge. So here is a picture of Stonehenge, and it's sort of, I think the color is better on your handout. You may have to sort of get used to looking at the screen here just for a sense of direction, and then actually looking for the things on the handout, okay? So, Stonehenge has lots of magical coincidences. I don't know if it's coincidences, maybe it's designed by the gods or whatever, but it has lots of miraculous properties. So if at a certain day of the year you look at one stone through the opening between two other stones, you'll see the sun just there at sunrise. Okay? So, and I suppose the picture is supposed to illustrate that. It's a real picture. And there are various other such coincidences associated with this. And the moral is that already in ancient times, people knew to look for cosmic coincidences. That cosmic coincidences are a good and useful thing. So my first task for today will be to define cosmic coincidences in a completely different context and tell you how to, and since these are such wonderful things, since these are so valuable things, I'm going to count them, manipulate them, do all sorts of things to them. Okay? Anyway, the realizations of cosmic coincidences are as astrological lineups, if you wish, are valuable, are much older than the so-called Gaussian linking number. But I guess I'll start by telling you what the Gaussian linking number. So the Gaussian linking number is a property of two-component knots. So if you have a two-component knot, let's make one. First of all, what's a knot? Okay, a knot is a circle in R3. Here is one. Considered up to deformation. So the one I had before is the same as this one, and it's also the same as that one. Okay, but it's definitely different than that. It's definitely different. This is all on video. So it's definitely different than this one, but this, on the other hand, is the same as that. Okay? So now you know all of knot theory. Now, a link is a knot with two components. So here is a boring link with two components. One component is embedded here near my left hand. The other component is embedded here next to my right hand. These two components have so-called linking number zero. They're not linked. However, if they pass through each other, now they have linking number one. So what's the definition of the linking number? The linking number is when you look at the two components, you project them to the plane, you draw them, well, in this case both are just circles, and you count the number of times one component is over the other. So you count the number of intersections in the projection in which both components are involved. You count them with signs. So there is a certain right-hand law, and I will not bore you with this right-hand law, but something like you hold one component with your right hand so that your thumb is pointing in the direction of the flow, then you look at your finger. Some one of those right-hand laws that if many of you are physicists, I believe, so if you've seen magnetism, it's more or less the same kind of right-hand law. Okay? Is this fine that I'm skipping it? Anyway, you count these crossings with signs, you divide by two, and that's the linking number. So in fact, in this case, there are two relevant crossings. Well, in a projection, there will be three more, like the crossings coming from this part, but I told you only to count crossings between the two different components. So there are two, one here, and it turns out that they come with the same sign, so the total count is 2 divided by 2, the linking number is 1. In the previous case, this case, well, the linking number is 0 because there are no crossings between the two. But if I put them next to each other, now there are two crossings, one here, but they come with opposite signs, as it turns out. So basically, you know, if you trace on the top component, on this component, one time you cross this one going from left to right, and another time from right to left. So you kind of see that there will be some sign difference. So the overall linking number is still zero. Anyway, I claim that this ancient invariant due to Gauss is in fact a counting of cosmic coincidences. So what's a cosmic coincidence? I guess in this case, what we're counting is, I guess, something that can happen in Colombia but cannot happen in Canada. So, you know, we put our link on the floor. Okay, I've put it on the floor, you can see it, so I'll raise it, but think that it's in the floor. And I'm counting all the places in which I could place a chopstick, okay? So that one, that's a broken chopstick, but it's still a chopstick. So that one end of the chopstick is on one component, the other end of the chopstick is on the other component, and the chopstick is pointing precisely at the sun when the sun is at zenith. Okay? Precisely above you. Okay? So that's the same as counting the number of intersections in the projection. But I'm thinking about it a bit differently. I'm thinking of it as counting vertical chopsticks pointing straight at the sun. Sun being the most mythological object there is. The most, I don't know, astrological object there is. Anyway, let me try to generalize this to situations in which there are several stars, and I want to make a more complicated count. So, suppose in advance we have chosen several, a large number, of important stars in heavens. Heavens is in fact just a sphere, S2. Right? So really I'm choosing points in S2. But you know, I've chosen one to be the North Star, another one to be, I don't know what, Sirius is how you pronounce it? Another one is, I don't know, just Vega, I think. There's one called Vega. Another one would be Vulcan, or whatever you want, okay? Choose them in some fixed generic position. For the purpose of this example, now let's assume that these are, let's assume that we fix them to be this light bulb, that light bulb, and that light bulb. And what I want to count, and I guess I now need help from a volunteer, And since Sylvie invited me here, she will be the volunteer. So please hold my notes. What I want to, you know what, let's make it a bit longer. So what I want to count is chopsticks structures that I can build on my knot, in which, well, each chopstick has one end on the knot, and the other ends of the chopsticks are joined together, are in a certain fixed point in R3, and the chopsticks are all pointing at stars. Well, it's a bit hard to do it, but I guess you get the principle. And the picture here shows you more precisely what I mean. So that's what I want to count. Okay? This is the definition of the Stonehenge pairing of a diagram D and a knot K. The knot you understand, the diagram will be any trivalent graph. Well, in our case, it was the graph shown here, but it would be any trivalent graph with a distinguished circle. The circle corresponds to the knot itself, to the parameter space of the knot, which is just a circle. The other edges correspond to the chopsticks. And when I say the cosmic count, the Stonehenge pairing of this diagram with this knot, what I mean is count in how many ways you can place these chopsticks on the knot, or place this graph on the knot, so that each of the chopsticks is pointing at one of the stars you've chosen in advance. And there will be some sign in involved, and I'm not going to tell you what the signs are, but it's a sign count. You count with plus minus signs. Okay? So is the definition of the Stonehenge pairing more or less clear? Again, except for the signs? Okay. So, you know, maybe before doing anything with the Stonehenge pairing, let me calculate sort of how many equations and unknowns I have, say, for this case. So in this case, how many unknowns are there? The unknowns are where to put the ends of the chopsticks. Okay, so the 1, 2, 3 points in S1. So I have three unknowns, or if you want, the unknowns live in S1 raised to the power 3. But then there is another unknown, which is where to put the vertex. Okay? Where in R3 is that point in which the three chopsticks meet? Okay? By the way, I should have said that chopsticks for me are straight lines, but they don't have to have fixed length. So a broken chopstick is the same as a chopstick. The length of the chopstick is not a part of the story. Anyway, so there are three more unknowns, and this is the coordinates of in R3 of this point. So there are three more unknowns, or if you wish, the unknowns live in S1 cross cube cross R3. Okay? And how many, so these are the unknowns, How many equations do we have? Equations. Well, each chopstick is supposed to point at a point in heavens. Heavens is two-dimensional. Stars are zero-dimensional, they're point objects. So each chopstick is two equations. That chopstick is to point straight at the star. Okay, that's two equations. So there are 2 plus 2 plus 2 equations. Or if you wish, really, we have a function I don't know, let's call it phi, which from every configuration of endpoints, so from every configuration of these endpoints, maps into the directions of the three chopsticks. So those directions are just three points, are just three points in S2, so it's a point in S2 cross S2 cross S2. Okay? Now, the number of unknowns is 6, the number of equations is also 6, and so we expect that the number of, that the space of solutions would be zero-dimensional. So we expect a finite number of solutions, again with signs. And again, if you want to think more about the signs come from the fact that what we're really doing is we're picking a generic point in this manifold and counting its inverse images in that manifold. And whenever you're counting the, whenever you're looking at the inverse image of, whenever you have a map between two manifolds of the same dimension, it could either locally preserve orientation or not. And that's where the signs are coming from. Okay. Yes?
If I would choose 3, we choose 4 stars now, you were concerned.
So, in fact, I choose a very large number of stars, like the whole Milky Way. Okay? But still a finite number. So, the condition that a chopstick is pointing at a star is still a codimension 2 condition, even if there are 10 billion stars, 100 billion stars, okay? Okay, so, right, so the correct, the real question is why did I choose just 3 chopsticks? And the answer is I didn't have to. In fact, I could equally well count cosmic coincidences involving this diagram of chopsticks. So again, let me try to tell you what a cosmic coincidence involving this diagram would mean. Well, this diagram has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 chopsticks. I guess I have 5 chopsticks here. And a cosmic coincidence involving this would be, well, 3 of them meet at one point in R3, 3 of them meet in another point in R3, and the 4 remaining ends are on the knot itself, which unfortunately is not being held by the main thing that mathematicians do is to imagine things that don't really exist, so I okay. Anyway, so how many, let's do the same dimension count here, okay? So each chopstick is 2 equations because we have to point at one of the 10 billion stars in the Milky Way. But it's still 2 equations per chopstick. How many unknowns do we have? This has to be on the knot, which is one dimensional. 1, 1, 1. We also have a point in R3 which could be anywhere, a point in R3 which could be anywhere. So the number of equations we have is 5 times 2. The number of unknowns we have is 3 times 2 plus 4 times 1, and I think it checks. Okay? So again, we expect a finite number, and you can check that whenever you have a trivalent graph, the expected count is, sorry, the expected dimension is 0, so the count will be finite. What? Oh, trivalent. A graph is trivalent is if in every vertex, you have 3 edges coming out of it. So, in fact, there are 2 types of edges in our graph, okay? Because there is a distinguished circle. I mean, the circle outside maybe should be drawn in a different color, okay? But still, all edges, all vertices are trivalent. I mean, right, either 3 chopsticks are meeting at the point or 1 chopstick is connected to the knot, it's still prevalent. Yes?
So by looking at S2, you're considering also stars at infinity, right?
by looking at S2.
Since you are saying that the stars are coordinates in S2, then you could have stars at infinity, like horizontal chopsticks or something.
Well, the note is in R3. I don't know what the word horizontal means. The word, I mean,
like
the note is here in R3. Horizontal is your choice. I mean, you've chosen this to be horizontal. It's completely arbitrary choice. It's not a part of the structure of R3. Now, S2 is heavens. It's all of heavens. It could be any direction. Yes. Okay? Anyway, so you see, I'm a mathematician and I'm doing expansions. So the next thing I want to do is to, oh my God, I'm sorry. It's really not showing some of the rules. Anyway, the next thing I want to do is to make a generating function. Right? If I have a sequence of numbers, a collection of numbers, those cosmic counts, I want to make a generating function that will include all of them. Okay? So let's define z of a knot k. So pick a fixed knot, this you fix, and define z of k to be, this is a complicated formula. Let me tell you what to look at and also what not to look at. So this is just annoying combinatorial factor. Ignore it. Okay? The lim, I'll explain at the end. But it's the limit as n goes to infinity of the number of stars. Capital N is the number of stars, and I really want to take this number to be very, 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 very big. Okay? Even more than 100 billion. So take the sum over all trivalent graphs. So that's an example. That's another example, but of course there are many, many more. For each trivalent graph, compute the Stonehenge pairing of that graph with the knot k. So that's this pairing symbol with a little bit with the Stonehenge symbol just below it. Okay? And I want to make a generating function. So what I'll do is I'll take this number and multiply it by the graph itself, by the diagram D itself. And now what I get is a huge linear combination of diagrams. Okay? So, for a typical knot, I will get something like 22 times this diagram plus 19 times this diagram minus 7 times whatever, another diagram that you could possibly put here. Okay? And this lives in but then there will be those denominators, so this could be actually rational numbers because I artificially divide by stuff. Okay? And then these things will live in a space which I will call A of a circle, and A of a circle is just the set of all formal linear combinations of diagrams of the kinds that we're considering. With oriented vertices, I don't think I've explained it, but at the moment it's not necessary. But basically, for the signs to make sense, you have to choose in each internal vertex an orientation. So for each internal vertex, you have to choose which chopstick is first, which one is second, which one is third, and you choose it up to a cyclic ordering. So, okay? So A is this space of formal linear combinations of such diagrams, and in fact, modulus on further relations, which we will come to in a minute. Okay?
The knot itself is encoded only in this numbers.
The knot itself becomes those coefficients.
So my question is, I guess, whether for every knot, every diagram may appear.
For every knot, every diagram may appear, yes. Though it could be that some diagrams will have a coefficient zero. Okay. Next, So here is the claim. Modulo sum relations, which I will explain in a minute, but are already shown on the board, the resulting thing, Z of K, is a not invariant. So it's independent on whether you deform the knot. It does not change when you deform the knot. And furthermore, it does not depend on all choices. So, you know, if there is an earthquake and those stars move a little bit, the thing doesn't change. Okay? Or, you know, if Milky Way, you know, Milky Way is always in motion, so it makes sense. Anyway, here is the splash scene, really. This is the key point of today's lecture. Let's check if it is invariant. Okay? So here is a very, very complicated cosmic situation, and I want to try to deform it a little bit and see what happens. So, but let me first explain. So, in black is the knot itself. The truth is that it's not really important that it's a knot rather than just any curve in R3, so long as it doesn't self-intersect. Okay? So I put all the knotted part here in the corner, it doesn't interact with us, I just sort of left the rest to be a simple circle that or a simple curve that I could work with relatively easily. Now, there are several stars that we have chosen, that I've placed in advance. There is a blue star way down there. Okay, the arrow indicates where, but it's infinitely far away in that direction. And let me also tell you that it's a little bit behind the screen. Okay? Some depth behind. Also, there is a purple star, which is way far there, and it's again a little bit behind the screen, so in fact, I could almost draw it right here. Okay? Then, there is also a green star, and I'm afraid the projector can just barely shows it, but the green star is way up there and a little bit behind the screen. Okay? So now, here is a chopstick that wants to point at the blue star. Now, it could start anywhere along the knot, so long as it's pointing at the blue star. Okay? So it could start anywhere along the knot. In particular, it could start anywhere along this interval. Okay? So if you allow it to move through all the positions it might occupy, it spans a plane. This is the blue plane here. Okay? It's not really a plane because these are not straight lines. It's a ruled surface. But locally, I mean, if you look at a sufficiently small scale, it looks like a plane. Okay? Likewise, there is a green star which spans this plane, and there is a purple star which spans that plane. And when you have three planes in R3, they tend to intersect at a point. So that point in which those three planes intersect, purple, blue, green, is the point O in the middle. And the point O corresponds to a contribution to the Stonehenge coefficient, so to the coefficient of this diagram in Z. The diagram in which you have, I mean, I've put the colors here only for illustrations, only so that you see which edge corresponds to which chopstick, but really it's the Y diagram that I wrote right here and that I used at the beginning. Okay? Now, so by the way, here you already see the stability of the situation. Because if you deform by a little bit the picture, so you know, if you deform, then these three planes will move a little bit. Or perhaps if you move one of these stars, then these planes that are kind of sloped in, because the stars are behind the picture, might go a little bit move a little bit according to how you move the star, but when you have the intersection of three planes, it's stable. It stays an intersection of three planes. Okay? But now let's, until something dramatic happens. So let's look for that something dramatic. So suppose there was another star, the orange star. The orange star is way far, and it's in the plane of the screen. So chopsticks pointing at the orange star would form this plane, and it could be that the heights were just so arranged that, you know, like, think of these three planes, they form like a pyramid, but we're looking at the pyramid from inside, so we're seeing like a pyramidal valley. It could just be that the orange plane would intersect that valley and form a puddle, an orange puddle inside it, okay? Now, let's move everything again, and it could be that as things move, perhaps I push the orange star further to the back. It could be that the puddle will dry, will become smaller and smaller and smaller, and then sort of cross through the point O, and when actually it will reappear on the other side. But that would be a catastrophe. That would be a change. What would change? So, what would happen to the coefficient here? What?
Change the time?
No, nothing. You see, if this combination doesn't even count the orange plane. The orange chopstick doesn't even appear here. So if orange moves to the other side, who cares? So if I want to actually see what in Z does change, I have to look at something even deeper. Okay? So, suppose there was yet another star, the red star. And the red star is your eye. Okay? So, a chopstick pointing at the red star appears to you to be a single dot, a red dot. Let's consider the red dot labeled I in this picture. What is I? I is on the intersection line between orange and red, and directly above the straight line continuing the intersection line of purple and blue. By the way, likewise, there is H and X. H is on the intersection line of orange and purple, and continue and the continuation of the intersection line of blue and green. And likewise, there is X, and I will not list what X is because you can read the colors from the picture. Okay? Now, I is really a vertical chopstick. You see, I really stands for a small chopstick that connects the blue-purple line, which is sort of in the back, with the orange-green line, which is at the level of the screen. So I actually corresponds to a cosmic coincidence. It's the cosmic coincidence enumerated by the diagram I shown here. You know what? Maybe I'll try to make it bigger. It still is on your paper copy, okay? But anyway, what is the diagram I? Well, we have a green chopstick meeting with an orange chopstick at a point of R3, and the two of them are meeting the red chopstick. The red chopstick goes to the intersection point of orange and purple and blue, which is a point in R3. Okay? And orange and blue sorry, and purple and blue actually go back to the knot. So basically, the point I counts a contribution to this diagram. Likewise, the point H counts a contribution to that diagram, and the point X counts a contribution to that diagram. Now suppose I start moving the stars once again, and orange goes to the other side. Well, what would happen? Well, in fact, well, the configuration corresponding to I will disappear. But in fact, it will reappear right away as you cross O, except with the opposite sign, except in the back of the picture. But and it turns out that it reappears with the opposite signs. So as the orange plane crosses the point O, the sign of I flips. That's bad. You see, I claim that the result is an invariant, but if I see that the count changes, well, that's bad news. That's not an invariant. But fortunately, the count corresponding to H also flips at the same time, and the count corresponding to X also flips at the same time, so that if we mod out by the relation that I plus H plus X is declared to be zero, so now it's a quotient space of that space of diagrams, and in fact I lied to you about the signs, it's really I minus H plus X. Okay? But again, up to signs, I just mod out by this combination is equal to zero, then as orange crosses to the other side of O, the change in Z is a multiple of the sum of these three diagrams, which we've declared to be zero, so the result is so the result is that there is no change. When you look at the signs carefully, which I'm not doing, no, I cannot. I mean, I could, but it would take me a huge amount of making all the definitions precise.
And also, the particular shape of the triangle in the middle of X.
So this is not a crossing point. Like, my vertices are always trivalent. This is just a graph. It's not a planar graph. Okay? So, again, at a certain... if I kind of watch a movie of notes and I count the cosmic coincidences associated with it, at some discrete times there might be catastrophes. One of these catastrophes is that a plane could cross over an intersection point of three other planes. That's what we've just shown. And the cosmic count changes. However, if I impose the relation I is equal to H minus X, then, or you know, you should think of it sort of as I plus H plus X is equal to zero up to signs. Anyway, if I impose this relation, the overall count does not change. Okay? So let us impose this relation. By the way, already here, if you look very carefully, you can start seeing Lie algebras. And Lie algebras will come in much in force later, right? I mean, sort of, there is something called the Jacobi identity, which says that if you take the two brackets of three elements in three different ways, they add up to zero. And it turns out that this is the graphical picture corresponding to that Jacobi identity. But that's just a preview. I have nothing to say about it right now. Anyway, now what you do is you try to look for all other catastrophes that could possibly occur when you deform a knot. So another catastrophe that could occur is, so here the catastrophe was that a plane crossed through an intermediate in, in, through an internal intersection point. But another catastrophe that could occur is that, like, one of those lines that are generated by the intersection of two planes could in itself cut the knot, could cross through the knot. Generically, if you have a line and a one-dimensional object, they will miss each other. But as the line moves, it might cross through the knot itself. It might intersect the knot itself. And then you can carefully analyze what would change in Z when this happens. And it turns out that what changes is, again, three things change at the same time. So if you mod out by the relation which says that the sum of these three things is equal to zero, then nothing changes. So I also impose the so-called STU relation, which says that whenever in a diagram, if you have a Y picture made out of chopsticks, where the bottom of the Y is on the curve that indicates the knot, then you can replace it by just two chopsticks pointing on, well, meeting in this way or meeting in that way. Okay? And then, once again, then there is yet another catastrophe which I want to completely skip. But now my theorem is complete. It's not yet proven, it's not remotely proven, but at least it's more or less stated. So the statement is that this generating function of all possible cosmic coincidences, regarded as an element of a space A of all formal linear combinations of trivalent graphs with a distinguished circle, modulo two local relations and the correction that I didn't even specify. Okay, but modulo two local relations that turn out to be related to the algebras, but I'm not telling you how, or not yet telling you how. But anyway, modulo these two local relations is an invariant. Again, Z valued in linear combinations of diagrams, modulo relations is an invariant. Okay, so I guess part of my challenge for the remaining five talks is to tell you why this invariant is interesting, or how is it interesting, or how we can digest it a little better, and I'll have a lot to say, and I think I'm more or less running out of time, so I'll only start by telling you how this invariant was first discovered. So this invariant is a variation, and again, I will have to explain it later, of something that comes out of quantum field theory. Okay, so I'll mention it rather quickly. Okay, so this is what's on the board right now is the so-called Chern-Simons-Witten quantum field theory, and it's defined as follows. So, as follows. First of all, you take your knot, you embed it in R3, and then you look at the space, you fix any algebra, you consider the space of all G connections, which, when we're talking about R3, just amounts to saying one forms on R3 with values in that Lie algebra. So you integrate over all one forms in R3 with values in the Lie algebra. And the integrand is the following thing. So it has a piece which I will discuss later, and that's where the knot comes in. And a piece which is the so-called Chern-Simons term. So it's the exponential of I times the constant k, which you think of as being very large, divided by a number, I don't even know what it is, times times the integral over R3 of the trace of A wedge dA plus 2 thirds A wedge A wedge A. So you see, if A is a 1 form, then dA is a 2 form. A wedge dA will be a 3 form, so it can be integrated over R3. Likewise, A is a 1 form, A wedge A wedge A is a 3 form. Again, can be integrated over R3 after taking trace, because everything is Lie algebra valued. So that's an integral of a number. This number you multiply by I and by some constant, and you exponentiate, you get a number. And that number you multiply by the so-called holonomy along the node K of the one form A. So basically, a one form gives you a one form with values in a Lie algebra gives you an element of the Lie algebra for every vector in R3. So if you have a vector in R3, again, you can do the chopstick, you get an element of the Lie algebra. So you get an infinitesimal, so if you look at the tangent to the knot, then that's a vector in R3 for every point of the knot. So for every point of the knot, you get an infinitesimal rotation. That's what the Lie algebra is. So you multiply those infinitesimal rotations that you encounter along the knot, you multiply them in the order in which you encounter them as you walk along the knot. You get a global rotation, meaning a global element of the corresponding Lie group. You take, well, you pick a representation of that Lie group, so that global element becomes a matrix, you take the trace of that matrix, and that's the holonomy. So that's again a number, and you form the horrible integral of all of these numbers over the infinite dimensional space of connections. Now, what I'm going to tell you next time is how to compute such integrals. So, it turns out that, well, this is a so-called perturbed Gaussian integral. So it has a part which is quadratic, and a part which is cubic, which in some sense can be considered as small relative to the quadratic. It turns out that there are formulas for computing perturbed Gaussian integrals, or at least for computing the Taylor expansion with respect to this parameter k of these of such perturbed Gaussian integrals. And these formulas, well, I guess you develop them on Rn, but they turn out to be independent of n. They turn out to have obvious generalizations to infinite dimensions. So the plan would be to first study such integrals in Rn, derive formulas for what these integrals come out to be. These formulas will depend on n very, very mildly. So it will make sense to substitute n is equal to infinity, in some sense, and then instead of integrating over Rn, it will be integration over the infinite dimensional space of connections. The formulas in themselves are so-called Feynman diagram formulas. And when you look at the Feynman diagram formulas very, very carefully, in the case of the Chern-Simons-Witten theory, they turn out to be integrals which precisely measure these cosmic coincidences. So I was told that I have 5 more minutes, but I guess rather than starting a new subject, I think I prefer to quit right now with the sketch on the board. So basically the plan for tomorrow will be to understand Gaussian integration on Rn and at least vaguely relate it with this cosmic count of today. Later on, it will be completely reasonable for you to ask, well, I've derived an invariant either by one complicated procedure, this cosmic count, or by another cosmic, by another complicated procedure, meaning quantum field theory, it would be completely reasonable to ask, well, does this invariant mean anything? Does it measure anything really? Okay, or where does it come from? And that would be the task for the further lectures. Anyway, I'll stop here. Okay, but roughly speaking, I take the limit, I mean, this expansion, the Taylor business that I'm talking about, is about taking the limit as k goes to infinity. So really you should be thinking of k as being, or of 1 over k as being epsilon, and
it's a classic infinity.
Well, again, it's the Taylor expansion, so it's not just the zeroth order contribution, but it's the whole perturbative series around infinity. So it's not just the zeroth term of the Taylor expansion, but the whole Taylor expansion around epsilon equal to zero, or near epsilon equal to zero, where epsilon is 1 over k. So really what I will do is I will take the limit as k goes to infinity, and then form an expansion, and then form the Taylor expansion of that result, of that integral. Now, the Taylor expansion has, it's a graded object. You get one contribution in each degree. Okay? That contribution in each degree is a priori a real number, not an integer and not a rational number. You know, if you look at the Taylor expansion of an arbitrary real function, you get a sequence of arbitrary real numbers. Okay? Now, the space of diagrams that I talked about, well, turns out in itself to be graded. So diagrams can be more and more complicated. Essentially, you count the number of the vertices in a diagram and divide by 2. So this will be a diagram with 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices, so it's complexity 2. 4 vertices divided by 2, its complexity is 2. The complexity of this diagram is 3. The complexity of this diagram is 4. So basically, diagrams with higher and higher complexities, meaning with more and more vertices, and more chopsticks, and more structure, will correspond to counting, or to the terms in the Taylor expansion here, of higher and higher degree. Now, if you look at this, in each degree you only get a real number, a single real number, which I claim, in fact, turns out to be rational, but that's besides the point. But in each degree you get a single real number. However, that single real number also depends on which group you've chosen, and which to be the gauge group here, and which representation of it you've chosen in order to compute the trace of the holonomy. So that number actually depends on, so in fact it's not just a single number, it's a huge family of numbers, one for each group and one for each representation. And that corresponds to the fact that there are many, many graphs here of a given complexity. But again, the details will have to come later.
Is this last one?
Yeah.
You have any case 1 over x0, right? And it's many.
Yes.
And call it 1 over x bar.
Yeah, fine, h bar.
But yes, this discrete, this number is discrete. So it's not very clear how you're imposing. And this is in this expansion because it's natural. There is one question.
Yes.
The question is, does this thing distinguish and what is distinguishing a non from a non? When you put all this stuff in a bundle. So this is a little bit of this point of modern.
So you asked three questions.
Yes.
Let me answer all three. You know, I still have some time, it seems, so I maybe not as much. But okay, first of all, the fact that K is discrete, so, you know, you can, one of them. No, K is discrete. K is an integer. There are several answers. First of all, the way I've written it, k isn't really an integer, doesn't really have to be an integer. So on R3, where you think of a connection as being a Lie algebra valued one form, in fact, k can be a real number.
Then you're not actually the compare. The star operation is gone.
The star operation is gone.
But this is the star operation.
Well, there's a reality. Nothing will depend on that in what I do. Nothing will depend on that. So another way to answer it is, well, you know, if you have a sequence of numbers, okay, if you have a function defining the sequence 1 over n, it might still have a Taylor expansion. You might still be able to approximate it by a power series in n or in 1 over n. So I'm going to compute that approximation even though the function is not always defined but only defined on a discrete set. Okay, that still makes sense. And maybe that's the most right answer. I never claim analyticity. But you see, I said in the beginning, Taylor series have their power and have their weaknesses. So one of the points in which Taylor series have power is that you can work with them even if they don't converge. And even if they don't, you can speak about generating functions as formal objects, as power series with coefficients, and you don't have to worry about convergence. So in some sense, this infinite dimensional integral is just the inspiration to write a combinatorics. Sorry. It's just the inspiration for writing a certain generating function of combinatorial gadgets, but whether or not it converges, whether or not it's really an equality that the Taylor that this is the Taylor series of that is somehow irrelevant because this doesn't make sense anyway because it's an integral over an infinite dimensional space. I think this does your first, or this is I think answers your first question. The second question is, how does it detect knots? So you can compute it by techniques that come later. It doesn't fully detect knots.
I'm not. This is distinguish a knot.
Does it distinguish the knot? Not known. Maybe no. I am not sure. Sorry. It's possible that it was okay. It's not. I may be confused, but it's possible that it follows from recent results of Jorgen Andersen that it actually distinguishes the unknown. But I didn't make that claim. I only made the claim that it's an invariant, and for now it could be a stupid invariant. I will have to say a lot more before I can convince you that it's not a stupid invariant, that it actually has power. I mean, it can distinguish the trefoil from the unknown and many other things. Okay? So this is still in the future. As for the relationship with Hovanov homology, well, this invariant contains in it the Jones polynomial whose generalization is Hovanov homology. So, you know, if you want, you can think of it as there is the Jones polynomial, there is one generalization which is Z, which is this invariant, there is another generalization which is KH, which is Hovanov homology, and it would be absolutely wonderful to know and understand if you can complete this diamond. And there are some results on this, again by Hovanov and by Aaron Lauda and by Ben Webster. I mean, so there are some results about completing this diamond and finding a common generalization. Sorry, also by physicists like Witten and Rukov. I think the final word is far from having been said. So I mean, that's an absolutely wonderful question for, you know, for you.
For your question, what should I think of this integral? Is it generated functional or because this following part is...
Which integral? the one at the top, this one?
Yes.
How should you think of it?
Or is partition functional?
So, it depends if you're a physicist and therefore a believer in the religion of class integrals, or if you're an infidel mathematician. So if you're a physicist, you think, well, this is an integral, it exists, it makes sense. The mathematicians maybe didn't finish to dot the I's and cross the T's, but it's an integral. You compute it, it computes a function. We're computing the asymptotics of that function. The asymptotics of this function is a series, and since the terms of the series are what I talked about. So this is if you're a physicist. If you're a mathematician, you think this integral is nonsense, but it at least inspires rigorous mathematics, and the rigorous mathematics is what I talked about. Okay? Except I didn't talk about it completely, so it's not apparent that it's rigorous, but it is rigorous. Okay.
Other questions?
So, I'd like to make a comment which has something to do with your lecture. I would suggest to rename your pairings and not name them Stonehenge, but Infiernito pairings.
Sorry for my ignorance. What is it? It's a Colombian thing?
That's right. We're very near, so you could implement, I think, your cosmic coincidences between the area. We'll show you, and I'm sure you'll develop very inspiring views.
My apologies for all the Colombians in the audience. So,
any question? When this is an invariant, you chase it a little bit. Stonehenge is to the invariant.
So, you know, let me take you up on this. Okay? And the first page of my handout, can I borrow it? Sorry, because it's it will be a bit hard to find it on my computer. But you know, the first page of my handout here has a table which I may or may not end up discussing. Again, the handout is more potential stuff than actual stuff that I will talk about. But it contains in it several parallel theories. Okay? So this is a bit of the theory for knots. But there is also a parallel theory for so-called virtual knots, for so-called W knots, which are two-dimensional knots living in R4, these parallel theories may or may not correspond to the Colombian stuff. I don't know. Okay, I mean, this is joking. This isn't joking. But what I really mean is that there are other such stories, not based on this kind of cosmic coincidences, but on other kinds. Okay.
So let's thank Professor Nagy.